kind of picking it up from last week, but going in a bit of a different direction. And this is kind of picked up from the last of the five remembrances, the one that is speaking about how our actions are basically all we have. And this is the ground that we stand on. And my inspiration for the talk today came from this book, which we're really encouraging people to get a copy of and read. And in particular, a chapter in the book by Kathy Toldy, who I'd never heard of before. She is in the Suzuki Roshi lineage, so she teaches in California. And the title of her chapter is Feeling Our Way to Embodied Wisdom. Wow. Feeling our way to embodied wisdom, not reading our way, not going to enough Dharma talks, not whatever. Feeling our way to embodied wisdom. So I sat with this, and a lot of times it helps me to clarify what I want to talk about when I really consider the title of the talk. So I started with this title, and it didn't quite feel like my words. So then this turned into working with difficult emotions. But that didn't sound like a fun talk to me. So then that turned into transforming the energy of difficult emotions. Okay, I can do this. But that wasn't quite it yet. And this is what I settled on. I settled on standing firm, because this reminded me of that fifth remembrance, the ground that I stand on. So I settled on standing firm on the shaky ground of shifting emotions. Standing firm on the shaky ground. Whoa, do we feel this lately? Of shifting emotions, okay? So this is what we're going to talk about today. So I wanted to start with the story and end with the story. And I'll start with the story from long ago. This is 18th century Japan, Satsujo. Okay? So a little bit about Satsujo. She was a student of Hakuin. So if any of you remember Anne's Dharma talk last spring, or if any of you attended her Meditate and Create workshop, she spoke of Hakuin, who was an artist and a poet and a Zen teacher, which was, I think, very common at the time. These days, a lot of Zen teachers are psychotherapists. Those days, a lot of them were artists. I guess we go where the need is. So Satsujo was a young woman living, I suppose, in the same village as Hakuin, and her dad knew Hakuin. And her dad and her parents, her whole culture, I imagine, was pushing her in the direction of getting married young. So her dad was instructing her at the age of 15 to pray to the Bodhisattva canon for a husband. So she was doing this. She was minding her father and doing what she was asked to do, except one morning or one whatever, her dad walked in when she was supposed to be praying to canon, and she was sitting on the sutra book. And her dad, "What are you doing? You're supposed to be praying for a husband to canon." And she quoted Hakuin. She said, I'm paraphrasing. This is my interpretation of what I read. Hakuin says that everything has Buddha nature. So how is my butt different than a sutra book? So Hakuin heard about this from her dad. This got back to Hakuin, and Hakuin was like, yeah, she's okay. Maybe she can wait on the marriage. Let's get her in here. So Hakuin saw some promise here. So he accepted her as a student at this very young age, and her dad apparently went along with this, and she quickly developed this ability to be very direct, as evidenced by that remark, right? Very direct and very cutting, and very just no-nonsense. There are stories about her asking her teacher, asking Hakuin a question, and as soon as he started to answer in words, she would turn around and walk out the door. It wasn't direct enough for her. So there are stories like this. Eventually, it came to a point where Hawkwind encouraged her to go out into the world and marry and live in a way and take her practice essentially off the cushion, live in a way that where he felt that she could have the most effect. In those days, women teachers probably couldn't be as effective in the world as if they lived the life of a mother and a grandmother, etc. So she eventually went that route, had children and grandchildren, which takes us to this koan, which is in The Hidden Lamp. Many of you have this book. And this is called Satsujo Weeps. When Satsujo, a great disciple of Hawkwind, was old, she lost her granddaughter, which grieved her very much. An old man from the neighborhood came and admonished her. Why are you wailing so much? If people hear this, they'll all say, the old lady once studied with Hawkwind and was enlightened. So now why is she mourning her granddaughter so much? You ought to lighten up a bit. Satsujo broke away from her weeping and glared at him and scolded him and said, you bald-headed fool, what do you know? My tears and weeping are better for my granddaughter than incense, flowers, and lamps. The old man left without a word. So let me just give this a moment. It's a beautiful koan in so many ways. So I think some remarkable things here, many remarkable things here, but the first thing I want to talk about is this neighbor's response. And I've myself experienced similar responses from people that are either new to Zen practice or don't practice at all and have this, I think, very misguided assumption that Zen practice takes us to a place where we're free from suffering or find this place of equanimity all the time to the point of we're blissed out and happy and peaceful all the time. Has anybody had experienced either assumptions themselves or from others around them? Right. So, I mean, it's a fair assumption and it's appealing in a way, especially for people that are suffering and want to not suffer. Who doesn't want to suffer? Who doesn't not want to suffer? You know what I'm saying? So I find that interesting. Another thing I think is so profound here is she is acting as a bodhisattva, is basically what she's saying here. She's crying as a grandmother because that's what a grandmother does when her granddaughter dies. And she's talking about the incense and the flowers and the lamps. This is the role of a Zen priest in the time. When somebody in the village dies, they offer incense, they offer flowers, she says lamps, I'm imagining they light candles. That's the role of a priest. Her role in this moment is a grandmother grieving her child or her granddaughter. So she understands her role, yet she finds a way to teach in that moment. Right? The neighbor comes and she finds a way. She finds clarity. So she's not so pulled into her emotions that she can't be clear when she needs to be. She's not indulging, is what I'm saying. So there's a really fine line that we walk as practitioners. Where is the skillful line to walk where we feel our emotions yet don't become so pulled by them that we can't find clarity when we need it. And she somehow does that. So another thing that occurred to me here is this neighbor's response. So he says, why are you wailing so much? You're so enlightened, right? I'm echoing conversations that I've had multiple times with a person that I know. Why are you being so angry right now? You meditate all the time, okay? You ought to lighten up a bit. And another thing that I think is relevant here is he, it seems, and maybe he feels like he's trying to alleviate her suffering in that moment. I suspect he's trying to alleviate his own discomfort at her display. And I've experienced this with people as well. He's uncomfortable with what she's feeling, which probably is a symptom of him resisting his own uncomfortable emotions when they arise. And this is all disguised as, don't feel bad, stop crying, pull it together, lighten up. Okay? So I want to go now to this chapter by Kathy Tolby. Do you know who she is? And just read a little bit of her words. So some practitioners, she says, think they should just let go of difficult feelings, yet nonetheless find themselves experiencing repeated negative patterns. If we don't uncover the problems that underlie our spiritual search, we risk placing a veneer of spirituality over deeply buried emotional wounds. I loved this. A veneer of spirituality over deeply buried emotional wounds. Spirituality can then lead us to actually split off from our emotional problems, repress them, and even deepen them. Emotions are energy, and energy has to go somewhere. In your idealized vision of yourself as a good Buddhist, you might convince yourself, oh, I'm not angry. But meanwhile, your heart is pounding, your stomach is churning, your adrenal glands are flooding your body with stress hormones. You're not angry, but your blood pressure is rising, you're tossing and turning, nursing revenge scenarios in your head, all of these things. It's funny, right? It's funny because it's true. Healthy emotional practice, she says, is neither repressing our feelings nor acting them out upon others. This is an important point. We feel like we have two, we often feel like we have those two choices. I can either keep my mouth shut or I can act out. There's a middle ground here that we often forget about. When we just allow sensations to flow through our bodies, we feel them arise and pass like a wave. We rest in present moment awareness, the act of awakening, of becoming a Buddha. And when I was sitting with this morning, I was sitting with this material sitting over here. That's where I sit. And I was moved to look at the, can everybody see it right now? So we feel like that's the Buddha. And that is a symbol of Shakyamuni Buddha, one of many that we often see. But that's not the only Buddha. This is the Buddha. No! Not you. Sorry, I wasn't yelling at you. Or a crying Buddha. Satsujo was absolutely a crying Buddha. It comes with all of that. So maybe... Who's the artist in the group? Maybe we create sculptures of Buddhas that are pissed off.
Angry Buddhas.
Angry Buddhas. Buddhas with tears. So I think this is important. I'll read one more chapter here. What we consider difficult emotions serve to deepen our experience and understanding. Sadness and grief open the heart. Guilt and remorse true us up as moral beings. Anger can motivate us to take action in the face of injustice. So I'd like all of us to reflect on these three sentences for a moment, and I'll leave you space to do this. So can you remember a time where sadness and grief opened your heart? And that this somehow made you more capable of meeting somebody else's sadness and grief? Okay. Guilt and remorse. This is the one that sometimes makes me cry. I won't, I promise. But guilt and remorse true us up as moral beings. Can you think of a time where you just did something really unskillful, really hurtful to another person? And somehow that, maybe it took some time, but somehow that transformed into the conviction to never do that again. Or to do your best not to hurt somebody in the same way again. And then anger, this is one that's very alive for many of us right now. Anger can motivate us to take action in the face of injustice. I had an encounter that I won't get into now, but an encounter just a week ago or so where I felt like I was being disrespected and I was angry. And I found that middle way of not keeping my mouth shut, which I know I would have had a tendency to do in a similar situation many years ago. And I didn't act out. I collected myself, but I spoke for myself. And it was heard, which was, wow. It felt good to be angry and have it heard by this person that made me angry. So I started with a story from a long time ago, and I want to end with a story from a couple of weeks ago. And I'm going to try to reconnect this to the title of the Dharma Talk. Jennifer's trying to help me do this. So, standing firm on the shaky ground of shifting emotions. Satsujo absolutely did this when she was weeping for her grandchild, and yet there was that shaky ground of the neighbor giving her a hard time, and she met that. So her emotions shifted like that in that moment. So a couple of weeks ago, I was in Target early in the morning, just picking up a few things, and a good 10 or 15 feet away from me was a young woman, clearly in distress, a young woman with two young children, an infant and a, what do you call the little stroller seat? In the car,
car seat.
In the car seat, an infant, and then a toddler in the front of the car, maybe 1 or 2 years old. She was crying. She was really upset, and I was concerned. So I asked her, "Are you okay?" And she met me in that moment, which was amazing. She met me. She looked me in the eyes, and she said, "I just found out my husband is cheating on me." Mm-hmm. So that was my response, and looking back on it, reflecting on it after this happened, some, I think, important things for me to say out loud are, I know that 10 years ago I wouldn't have been present enough to even notice the crying woman in Target. I would have been self-absorbed, thinking about my list, my day, whatever. So I think it's cool that I noticed. And also, I think it's cool that I know that several years ago, I would have seen that crying woman and I would have been like the neighbor. I would have been not like the Satsujo's neighbor. I would have been worse. I would have just gone like this. I would have walked away. So my reaction, I think, was a testament to practice. And also, my reaction wasn't about the guy. I felt no need to talk about what a jerk that guy was, how could he. There was none of this. There was only, here's a young woman and she's suffering, what can I do? So she was, I asked her, can I help you shop? What can I do for you? And she was looking for sidewalk chalk.
Oh.
She just wanted the kids to have sidewalk chalk. So I helped her find the sidewalk chalk. And then we parted, and then a few minutes later, I saw her again, and I wanted to give more. I said, please, can I buy you a cup of coffee? What do you need? Can I buy that toy that her kid was grabbing? Can I do something? And again, she met me, which was unbelievable, the strength of this woman, to see this stranger, and she was giving me this gift of allowing me to connect with her. She met me and she said, it's okay, my friend's over there, and I wanted to feel assured and that she had friends, that she had a support system. She assured me. So the whole encounter was, I mean, we're talking about a 10-minute encounter that clearly moved me so much. I'm still feeling this and processing this 2 or 3 weeks later. her strength, talk about shaky ground. Her marriage is crumbling and she's running errands with the kids and she's crying. Yet somehow she meets this stranger and allows that communication to happen. It was just, that woman is a Buddha. Absolutely. A crying Buddha. So I think that's enough. Thank you. Hyokai.
Yeah. That was great. You know, I think particularly for women who have been raised to stifle.
Put a lid on it.
Archie Bunker. It was like, we are supposed to, you know, you might feel it, but you don't say it, mm-hmm. You know, you don't express the anger or the sadness, but, you know, you just behave yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so to, you know, when I listen to you, to not just acknowledge that those feelings are there, but to actually rejoice in those feelings and to be skillful with those feelings. You know, I really appreciate the distinction of the, you know, that it's to not indulge it, mm-hmm. to allow it, to feel it, and to be skillful with it. I do have a question though about the grandmother's reaction to the neighbor. And I don't know if this is my own stuff or if this is a cultural thing at the time, but I certainly appreciate what she said about my tears are, you know, what are my display that is appropriate as opposed to doing incense and flowers. But she, the first thing she said to him is, "You old fool."
Right.
So I'm just kind of questioning the skillfulness of that,
mm-hmm.
you know. And, you know, when I'm angry and upset, you know, I would be thinking like that, well, you know. But the skillful part of me would hopefully not say that. Okay, so perhaps though, it's that time period and that culture, and also that is an interpretation. You know, I mean, it's a story.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows what she said? But I just had a little bit of a difficulty reconciling that initial response of name calling was skillful.
Thank you. I think this is wonderful. And I mean, there are a lot of ways we could go here, but maybe in that moment, I'll just play devil's advocate here. Maybe in that moment, that old fool needed to be called an old fool. Maybe that was the only way he could have heard. And this is all speculation. If the koan ends, he walked away. So we don't know he walked away because he felt, oh, he was awakened, he learned something, and he was put in his place. Or we don't know he walked away because he didn't, her words didn't land. We don't know. This is why practice is so, this is why it's a shaky, shifting ground of emotions. It would be awesome if we could find that point. And we live there, and this is our skillful means, and we always act from that place. But it's like driving a car; it doesn't work. The landscape is always changing, so this is why we always have to practice. Thanks, Karen.
I'm glad you mentioned that because maybe it's showing her humanness, that she doesn't have to be perfect.
Mm.
There's always gaps. And I think you began before the discussion of this kind of idealization of this spiritual person, whatever that is. There's always shadows, and Kong should present the shadows to her anger. That's the humanness.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have kind of the saint, you know, the smiling Buddha. So,
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you. So the shadow side is something so important and something that we work with. In our particular school in Open Mind Zen, we have a method called Zen Dialogue. Raise your hand if you've done Zen Dialogue, a few of us. That's very effective at bringing these unconscious parts, these shadow parts, into consciousness, and not as a way of getting rid of them, or as a way of integrating them in a very aware way. So this is really, I think, what Zen practice is about. Thanks. Anything else? Four vows of the Bodhisattva. Right at 11:30 on the dot. Well done.